One.
Gottlieb is giving like two lectures. Should we sort of?
So that every it's a tradition.
He's doing two successive.
Yes.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Nicole Beauchemin. I am a senior researcher in the Goodman Cancer Research Center, and I'll be your moderator for this evening. Welcome to the Rosalind and Morris Goodman Cancer Research Center and the Goodman Public Lecture. This year's series is entitled Cancer, Looking for Simplicity and Finding Complexity. Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Mon nom est Nicole Beauchemin. Comme vous voyez, je suis une chercheure senior du centre. Je vous invite à participer avec nous ce soir à cette soirée de forum public de Goodman. Le titre de toute cette série, nous avons donné le titre « Cancer, chercher la simplicité et trouver la complexité ». And tonight, cancer below the belt, times two. The first series was on prostate cancer, and this series tonight is on cervical and ovarian cancer. And I want to introduce you first to a very special member of our audience. Down here, next to me, is a big dog. His name is Pudding. He's a mirror dog. He accompanies Anne-Marie wherever she goes, whether her office, her lab, a meeting, or a seminar. So Pudding is here to help me tonight to pull them out if they go over the 20 minutes. So before we start, since there may be a few people who have not yet seen our tremendous video, so you will have the music in your ear all evening. Providing I start it. Providing I start it. Damn. No, I know. It was working. Sorry, I want to get this. Dum da dum.
Michel sends his best. He's at a grand panel tonight. So if in case you're wondering, there's been 476,000 clicks on this video. And as you know, every click on the video is a few cents in our till. And we are doing lots of wonderful things with this. So we encourage you, if you don't know it, McGill Dances for Cancer on YouTube, easy enough to find. So tonight, the topic of tonight is quite serious. We're going to be talking about cervical and ovarian cancer. And before we go on with our guests, let me introduce you to four wonderful women. The little one on the side cut off is Kristen. Kathy was her mother. She was 34 when she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She had a year and a half. Kristen was 4 years old. This is Lily. Lily's my mother-in-law. Lily's had breast cancer and skin cancer. This is Betty, the older sister. Betty was very much involved in helping with Kathy's care. And a few years after Kathy passed away, Betty started noticing some symptoms that seemed, strangely enough, to be pretty much the same as what Kathy had sort of noticed in the first place. And so Betty went to see the same physician. This happened in California. Betty had ovarian cancer. But because she knew what her sister had, she was diagnosed fairly early. She went through gruesome treatments. Betty had 6 years. Both of them have passed away. This is a picture of Kristen at 11. Notice how she looks like her mom. Kathy is wearing a wig. This was like a couple of months before she passed away. Kristen is now Kristen Nicole. And you wonder why, huh? She's my filleule. Qu'est-ce que c'est, filleule? Godchild. Kristen is now 29. Kristen is getting follow-ups every year. This was my first encounter with ovarian cancer. Knowledge is power. So to tell us more about this tonight, we have one of Montreal, Canada, and international speaker who is a well-renowned clinician here in Montreal, Dr. Walter Gottlieb. He's professor of obstetric gynecology and oncology. He's the director of the Surgical Oncology Clinic at McGill University. He's director of gynae and oncology at the Siegel Cancer Center. And it's our great pleasure to have Dr. Gottlieb to speak to us tonight. I have to tell you, we have a little bit of a change in the program. One of our speakers has been really ill all week, and so Dr. Gottlieb has accepted to give two talks, one on the introduction of ovarian cancer. Then he will be followed by Anne-Marie Mesmasson, and he will come back to talk to us about a new surgical techniques using robotics. And then we will have a patient testimonial. Dr. Gottlieb.
Hi. I'm honored to be here, and I'm honored to see that, and humbled, actually, that the audience is full. So the first thing I realized when I came into the room after seeing the dog, of course, was that we're still in summer. And Actually, going outside, it felt pretty good today. So what I'd like to talk to you about is kind of talk to you about ovarian cancer and where we feel a big paradigm shift in our view of ovarian cancer. And actually, my lecture is actually basically an introduction to Dr. Mesmasson's talk, which she will give in a few moments. But we didn't speak about it before, so I hope it's going to be smooth and it's going to go over well. So what I would like to do is first to kind of introduce you to ovarian cancer, and I'd like to talk to you then about the old paradigm, which is clinical trials. And ultimately, I want to bring you into the molecular era that Dr. Mesmasson is going to talk about. So this is the bad news. With the turn of the century, cancer has become the first cause of death in the Western world, which is more than cardiovascular disease and all of the other diseases. So basically, cancer, both in women here in yellow, in men here in blue, counts for death of one in three persons. So I don't want to sound dramatic, but if you turn to your left side, and then you turn to your right side, one of those three will die from cancer. Now, we all have to die. We all agree on that. Nobody gets out of here alive. But cancer is really not the way we want to leave this earth. And this is a small video about ovarian cancer. Let me see.
Ovarian cancer tends to affect women who delay childbearing during the course of their lives.
I'll let you look
and
through it.
Have fewer pregnancies.
Oh no! You just watch it. Don't worry about the sound. I'm gonna even take it off, so you don't have to worry about it. Right. So what they show you here? There we go. So what we see is the female pelvis coming in. It's from the Ovarian Cancer Society video. And we see the uterus in the middle. We see the fallopian tubes, the ovary. And in this video, which is a few years old, they still describe ovarian starting really in one of those cells in the ovary. And there are some new theories that are ongoing where we don't know. So we have one of those cells that becomes a little bit crazy and starts to grow because of its abnormal mechanisms going on in the control of the cell. And I like to compare that a little bit to a car where you have a brake and then you have a gas pedal. And if you don't manage those two very well, either your brake pedal doesn't work and you can't stop, or you push too much on the gas and it gets stuck and you can't stop either. So any of those mechanisms, and you see the tumor growing in that ovary somewhere deep in the pelvis, and the ovary is not innervated, so you don't feel it. And the good thing, of course, is it's not innervated, because if not every month, it would be terrible for women. But one of the things that the disadvantage is, obviously, that it can develop without feeling. And then, you start having that thing that grows inside, and usually by that time, people start wondering what's going on, which explains why most of these cancer are at a very late stage. And what we see here, we are looking over the uterus, and we have those cells, which are cancer cells, which are shed by that ovary and just go traveling in the perineal cavity, which is actually a virtual cavity. It's just there, and there is always liquid, so they just use the liquid to travel around and to go and set either on the ball here, they just settle down on the ball, or they go up to the liver that we see here, or the diaphragm that's just above. And what we see, actually, is just this is not real metastases. These are just those cells shedding and just going and finding a nice place to settle down. And this is then where they settle down throughout the abdomen. And that explains, again, why ovarian cancer is only diagnosed at a pretty late stage when it grows and it starts causing problems. So this has been our trajectory with ovarian cancers from the 50s to, 2012, somewhere here. And this is the survival in month of patients with ovarian cancer. And we just heard that story from Nicole where, overall, if you were diagnosed with ovarian cancer in the 50s, your survival was less than a year. There was just, you know, very poor treatments available, and the diagnosis was basically fatal. In the late 70s, we saw cisplatinum arrive, and there was a revolution in the treatment for ovarian cancer, and we started for the first time to see improvement in survival. This was then replaced, the cisplatinum was replaced by multi-agent chemotherapy, where we added, and here this is CAP, which was very classical, which was cisplatinum, Adriamycin, and cyclophosphamide. That was a terrible regimen. I remember giving that. That was really made people incredibly sick. And then in the early 90s, we got Taxol that replaced the ANDP here. So we got cisplatinum and Taxol, and suddenly we saw a great improvement in survival in the time people survived. And they started to survive longer and longer, and more trials were done, where we're getting here into the trials we're doing now. And as you could see here, if you take kind of where patients now are, you know, they're close to 6 years of survival with ovarian cancer. The problem, and this is shown in this slide, the problem when you look at the incidence of ovarian cancer, that has remained plus minus stable over the years. Again, you have from 1975 to 2008. And the incidence, that means the number of cases per year, is kind of similar. But you see that the survival rate or the mortality here that's shown here in pink is also stable. So we're kind of a little bit in that paradox where on one hand we saw an improvement in the number of months that patients live, but that did not translate in improved cure rate. So our cure rate has remained stable over the years, whereas we do improve dramatically in the amount of time, from less than a year to over 6 years that patients live with cancer. But ultimately, they still will die from their ovarian cancer, except for a very small minority of patients. So this is kind of where we stand with it, and we're very embarrassed, and we need to do better. And these type of things, instead of being a hurdle, we could look at this as an opportunity. We have to do better. The good news... Oh, before I go to the good news, it comes. So we've talked about screening. Maybe we could early detect ovarian cancer. And here in Montreal, there's been big movements to do early detection and screening. And the U.S. Preventative Task Force came out just now in September with their recommendation. This is the third recommendation over a decade that has basically not changed. And what they say about screening for ovarian cancer is that that screening did not improve cancer-specific mortality compared with usual care, and that there is a risk of potential harms associated with abnormal screens. So let me show you very quickly what they based their study on. This is based on three big, big international studies, and the American study already came out. So the American study, what they did, which is called the PLCO study, they took 68,000 women, and they divided them up in two groups. Mean age is written here, and the number of years of follow-up is written here. This is a very well-done study. Half of the patients, 30,000, got standard care, whatever standard care might mean, which is the best we can give today. And in those 30,000 women, they found 175 ovarian cancer, 176, with three-quarters of the cancers being advanced, exactly what we would expect, exactly what was explained by the video. And 100 patients died from ovarian cancer during those 13 years. When they now looked at the screened group, they found 212 ovarian cancer in the screened group. Interestingly, well, not interestingly, unfortunately, 77% within the screened group were also advanced cancer, meaning that the screening patients did not shift that group to earlier stage. Three-quarters were still advanced stage, despite continuous screening. And they had 118 deaths within that group, meaning that screening actually didn't change anything in the number of cancers, didn't change anything in the stage at which time we discovered the cancer, and didn't change anything in the survival rate. So screening clearly in the general population is out. Not only is it out, but when you take the false positives, that means patients who had an abnormal screen and ultimately did not have ovarian cancer. There were 3,000 of those. That's just very recent data. 3,000 of those, and 1,000 underwent surgery for that screen, for that abnormal screen. That's 1,000 women who did not need surgery. And in those, they found 15% major complications. So if that is in a screened group, that you can't improve things, you can't really improve things with early detection when patients already have symptoms. That just somewhere I cannot understand that. That's simply not possible. So we need to find better. We need to do better. We needed these studies, which took 20 years to accumulate, in order to realize that we absolutely need to find something better. And Anne-Marie will talk to you about that. So what's the good news? I promise you good news. Well, the good news is that people used to die from infectious diseases. That was the biggest killer at the turn of the previous century, until Sir Fleming discovered antibiotics. Now, he didn't discover antibiotics in a vacuum. He discovered antibiotics because he had the tool. He had the Petri dish, and he had the microscope, which allowed him to discover something very unusual, and he was, he saw something unusual in his Petri dish that allowed him to discover antibiotics. And suddenly, people didn't die of infectious diseases anymore. Now, we're not talking very long ago. That's 1950, right? That's yesterday. So people didn't die of infectious diseases, so what did they start dying from? Cardiovascular disease. What happened with cardiovascular disease? Well, we became better thanks to anesthesia and to surgery. We became better at operating coronary artery disease. We became better with treatments, antihypertensive medication, statins, treatments for anger. So suddenly, also, stents, suddenly cardiovascular disease gave way. And people with cardiovascular disease, live 20, 30 years, no problem, after their heart attack. So we're left over with cancer. Now, the good news is that we have the tools today to take care of cancer. We've learned the molecular tools. We've learned, to do genome sequencing. We have the whole genome sequence. We are doing sequencing now privately. You can do a full sequence of your DNA for $8,000. And you would know all your sequence. Doesn't mean you'd know what to do with it, but at least you can know your sequence. So we're there. We're at the verge. We have the tools, and we start seeing the first results from those tools. So this is kind of my view of the world. So somewhere, and we're still in that area of kind of those dinosaurs, where we decided how treatments should be. And I'll explain that in a moment. But we're at the verge, and we're already part of it, of that molecular era. And that's extremely excited for us researchers. So in that kind of evidence-based medicine, how we like to call it, we look at the organ of origin. So that's geographic. A tumor starts in the ovary. And we look at the morphology. It's a mucinous tumor. It's a serous tumor. So we look how it looks under the microscope. And then we're going to do huge clinical trials, 2,000 patients, 1,000 patients. And I'll go into that in the next part of my talk. These are very slow and limited ways of where we can impact. But they've worked well. We saw that in the previous slide, where we evolved from a year to 6 years. We are going into a molecular signature era, where we're going to phenotype molecularly the cancer and its environment, where we're going to try to understand really what's going on, where we're going to develop targeted therapies that are driven by biomarkers, by things we can measure to make personalized medicine. And although this is very complex and pretty costly, if we remain focused on specifics, this will be very easy and affordable to do. So that's for the introduction. Clinical trials. What are we today? What are we doing today? So let me just bring you to through the microscope of what we do in the clinic. This is an example of, these are just preclinical. So before we go into the clinic, this is the bark of the yew tree. Now, the bark of the Pacific yew tree is special because this is where we got Taxol from. Taxol, which is a very important drug in our armamentarium, in a lot of cancers. And in order to treat one patient, when Taxol came out in 1991, in order to treat one patient, you needed to have a whole tree and take the bark of a whole tree. So when people ask me sometimes, you know, is the product you're giving me natural? Of course it's natural. Yeah, it comes from a yew tree. Now, instead of cutting all those poor trees, what we can do, we can synthesize them to get today in the lab. So they cut that bark of the yew tree for quite a long time. And in the next phase, they analyze it and see what it does in the lab and if it kills cancer cells. Once it has done that and passed, and we see that it kills the cells in the petri dish, you know, we're going to try it on animals, usually mice, in the lab. If all of that works, then we're going to try and go over to a phase one. Now, what is a phase one trial? A phase one trial is really to see if we give it to humans, do they react like mice? So we have a lot of treatments in the lab. And if you're a mouse, I can cure you, no problem. The problem in humans, it's way more difficult. So the first thing we do is we check what it does in the lab. And the first thing we want to know is it's not too toxic. So we start with a very low dose to give to a few patients, and if they tolerate it, we go to the next level. And to the next level until we start seeing some intolerance. And then we go back to the previous dose, which is called the maximum tolerated dose. And that's the dose we're going to take to the next phase, the phase two. In the phase two, we're going to treat a whole bunch of patients and see how they react to that maximum tolerated dose. And if they react well and we can see good results and they respond to the treatment, then we go over to the final step, which is the phase three. And the phase three is where we have our new drug here on the horse trying to beat the previous king, which is the standard drug we had. And this is how we have evolved over the time. So now if we look at what it means that in order to find one drug that ultimately will be approved, statistically you need about 10,000 compounds you're going to check. Out of those 10,000 compounds, 250 will ultimately get through preclinical trials. That's the in vitro and the mice stuff. Out of those, 5 compounds will go and make it through phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 to ultimately be approved. Now, this, as you can see, is a very long process, including many patients, here 1,000 to 5,000 patients in phase 3 trials, a very long and costly process. We have to do better than that. This is how we got up to here. So we compared cisplatinum to melphalan, then we compared cap to cisplatinum, then we compared cistaxel to cap, and so on and so on. And this is how we very slowly over the years improve our outcome. But as I said, we haven't changed cure rates. And in order to do that, I think we need to get into the molecular era. The good thing is we're there. We're in the molecular era. And in that era, what we're going to try to do is to understand what goes on in here. And if we understand, maybe we can target it. So this is our historical geotopographical way of treating cancer. So we have a cancer in the ovary, and it can be this type under the microscope, that type under the microscope. You know, it looks under the microscope, and then we treat it. And usually we're going to treat, you know, almost everybody the same way because that's what those huge trials have taught us. We can't do a trial of 5,000 people just for this and 5,000 just for... So we treat everybody the same, and we try to get the best response. So if we, for instance, have an 80% response rate, which is fabulous, still means 20% don't respond. And if we could know beforehand who those 20% are, we don't have to give them treatments that aren't going to make them sick. We should give them something else that's going to help them. So this is where the molecular era comes in. So let's just take the serous ones, which are the most frequent ones, and let's analyze them. And this is basically an expression array. What is an expression array? You see a lot of dots. Each line here represents a patient. That's one patient. That's another patient. That's another patient. And each line here represents genes that we're testing to see how they're expressed. In red, they're underexpressed. In blue, they're overexpressed. And what we could see for the first patient here, She has a series of, sorry, this patient, a series of genes that are underexpressed and a series that are overexpressed, and that are completely different to this pattern. So what we could see here, those two patterns of all of these patients are similar and very different to those. But they all come from what looks under the microscope pretty similar. So what we're going to do is these two actually correspond to what we call low-grade cancers. LMP stands for low malignant potential. They're very indolent cancers. And grade 1 are also pretty indolent, whereas grade 2s and grade 3s are the more aggressive ones. There is no way we should treat this one, these patients, the same way as these. They have a completely different molecular way of creating the cancer. Represent it in a cell. That's the only one you're going to get. What we see if we go down deep into the cell, where this is the nucleus, these are all kinds of abnormalities, molecular abnormalities, in those low-grade ones that I showed you on the left of that previous graph. These abnormalities all create low-grade cancers, whereas the high-grade cancers are all due to a completely different mechanism here in black. What we have learned from that is that these do not become those. The low grades do not become high grades. They're two different animals. The low grades are low grades and will remain low grades for as long as they're around. The high grades, they're going to evolve right away from the beginning on as being high grades. And they're going to be really bad players. And there is no evolution from that early good stuff to worse stuff to very bad stuff. It's either good or bad from day one. Why? Because what drives those cells is completely different. Ultimately, we went over from this type of analysis to these type of analysis. And these type of analysis will allow us to do way more in an intelligent fashion to treat better patients. And we're there. We're already doing this, and we're already starting that. I'll just give you one example of something that was very exciting and started 3 or 4 years ago. And then I'll let Dr. Mesmason present you all the rest of the research she's doing. This is about PARP inhibitors. I don't know how many of you heard about that, but the concept is so exciting that I wanted to share it with you. If you have a normal cell, and if the DNA in the cell breaks, then the cell has two mechanisms to correct it, very simply put. One is BRCA-related, and the other one is PARP-related in the cell. That's how it corrects deficiency. So it has a redundancy of a mechanism to correct a problem in its DNA. And when the DNA breaks, these mechanisms start, and the DNA is repaired. In a BRCA patient, a BRCA patient, a patient who has a deficiency in BRCA, one mechanism doesn't exist. So if the cell breaks its DNA, it's completely dependent on that other mechanism, which is PARP. Now let's imagine, they discovered something that blocks PARP, a drug that's taken orally, just a drug, a tablet you take orally every day, that blocks PARP. In the normal cell, if you block PARP, BRCA still functions, the cell breaks, BRCA will still correct the cell. No problem, the normal cell doesn't care. In the cancer cell, on the other hand, if you block PARP because BRCA doesn't work, the cell will die. So you have a selective way of killing cancer cells. It's not like chemo, where you just kill a lot of cells and you hope you kill more cancer cells than good cells. Here it's different. Here you're specific, and that's why they call it synthetic lethality. You specifically are killing, and that's my last slide. I see the boss getting up. And the dog is still quiet, so I'm okay. So this is, again, the same thing, but as another slide. If you have a break in your DNA in a normal cell, even if you block PARP with a PARP inhibitor, the cell will survive. In a cancer cell, a BRCA deficient cell, if you block PARP, the cell will die. And this is the type of future we want to see. We want to see a future where you give something that doesn't make... And we've used those PARP inhibitors in the clinic. We have one patient who's already 4 years on it, nonstop. So these are the type of things, no symptoms. They take those inhibitors, they almost have no symptoms. Unfortunately, we're not completely there. That one patient is one out of six that took it, but she's already for many years. Out of the other five, out of the six, three responded very well, but for a few months. So we're slowly getting there. We still need to fine-tune things to understand better. But these are the type of treatments that we're really looking for. Thank you very much.
I forgot to mention that if you have any questions for the speakers, there are volunteers in the room with cards and pencils. Just raise your hands and they'll come to your... They were distributed. So raise your hands if you have questions, and some volunteers will pick up the questions and bring the questions down. I think what we'll do in the interest of time, continue writing your questions. We'll pick them up, but we'll ask Anne-Marie to come and present her talk. So before if you can do it now, and we'll read them off at the second... So our second speaker tonight will talk to us about work she's been doing for quite some time. Dr. Anne-Marie Mesmasson is scientific director of the Institut du Cancer de Montréal. She's the head of cancer research at the CHUM, and it's my great pleasure to welcome her. We've known each other for quite some time. She's going to talk to us about the secrets your tumor can tell us, les secrets que votre tumeur peut nous révéler.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be able to speak to you tonight on this subject. And I have to thank Dr. Gottlieb for giving most of my talk beforehand. So you might see some repetition, but repetition is often good because it allows the concepts to sink in. So really what I want to focus on now is the kind of research that has led us to the type of discoveries which you've heard about tonight. And you've heard Dr. Gottlieb talk to you about how the change in terms of cancer care is occurring. So in the 1990s, we had treated everybody the same. We hired large clinical trials. We looked in big numbers to see who was responding. And then after that, we decided that everybody would get exactly the same thing, even if we knew that some people would not benefit from the drugs. But at least we had something to offer everybody. We're going to an era of stratified care, and this is clearly demonstrated the forefront in some other cancers. For example, in breast cancer, where now we check whether the cancer cells are expressing certain receptors, and the choice of the treatment is really dictated by what the cancer cell looks like. And eventually, in an era of personalized medicine, as we start to understand more and more the causes of the different types of cancers, we're going to be using therapies that are much more, perhaps not individualized, but certainly on a small group of patients. And what do we need to be able to choose the right treatment for patients? What I'm going to be talking to you about in some detail are what we call biomarkers, so markers that will help us decide what type of treatments would be the most appropriate. So really what's helping to fuel this revolution, as we said, we are going to a molecular era where we're understanding more and more about what's going on. It's actually an important cornerstone to all of that has been the creation of tissue banks and more specifically tumor banks. So what these banks are, they're a professional activity where patients are recruited to studies And what we request from them, from the research side, is the permission to save some of their tumor tissues, some of their normal tissue from blood, sometimes urine, sometimes serum. And what we do is we preserve those in the laboratory and then use them for our experimentation. And what really helps us understand what's going on is the ability to tie that tissue to clinical data. So we have a tumor tissue, a patient is treated, and then we get to look back in time and say, ah, this is somebody who responded to our first-line therapy or somebody who did not respond to our first-line therapy. So it gives us a material from which to do our studies. So much of the work that has been done in oncology, and really it's a great deal of work, has been really to use mouse models, and you've heard Dr. Gottlieb speak about eloquently how we've gotten very good at curing mice of cancer, but we're not really so good at people. And so it means that while those mouse studies are absolutely necessary to really understand the underlying mechanism that causes cancer, at some point we have to make the leap from the mouse to the human and said, yes, but how do discoveries we make in mice actually apply to what we see in the patients we see in the clinic? And so these tumor banks provide us with tumor tissues that we can look at. And from these tumor tissues, we can either have them we can fix them in wax, which is what happens in pathology departments when a pathologist makes his diagnosis, and we can study them in the wax. We can actually take them fresh out of the body and flash freeze them so that we preserve much of the material that's inside of the tumor that we can study. Or in some cases, we can actually start to grow these tumors outside of the body in tissue culture, and we can develop them as cell lines and start studying them. And in fact, we can now actually circle back to the mice and take those human tumors, grow them in mice that don't have an immune system, and try to look at how they grow. So the tumors that we freeze or that we put in wax, we can either study the whole tumor or we can start to separate the tumor into little bits we have, because in a tumor, it's not just the tumor cell of itself, but there is stroma, there are blood vessels, there are immune cells, and all of those together form what we call the tumor microenvironment. So now we have the capability to not just look at the tumor cell, but see how that cell is talking to other cells in the body that usually control cell growth. The other thing that we have, which is a really powerful tool when we're trying to look at what's going on in a large set of tumors, is something called tissue microarrays. So in the old days, we used to get a block of wax that has the tumor in it. You can cut a slide off of that. You do an experiment on one. If you wanted to look at 1,000 women what was going on, you had to make 1,000 of these slides, and it was very costly and time-consuming. Nowadays, what you can do is you can start from a... If I have the pointer, you can start from one of these single slides. You can take a punch, we call it just a carrot, that you put, it's almost like a biopsy now, and you actually put it in this new block, and you put it together with tissue from lots of other patients. So now instead of when we do an experiment, instead of looking at one patient at a time, we can look at hundreds of patients at the time. And since we have all the clinical data for them, we can do statistical analysis much more rapidly in order to find out what the biology of the cancer is telling us in terms of what happens in the clinic. These tumors, I told you, can also grow outside the body. So you can grow them on plastic, and they grow as these flat cells. One of the problems of this, though, is that this doesn't really look a whole lot like a tumor. So when you look at it, these cells are growing in basically two dimensions. They don't really have any close neighbors, and that's not how tumors grow. And so tumors usually grow as a mass. So one of the things that we've been able to do is actually start to grow these tumors instead of on plastic, but actually grow them in three dimensions. We call them spheroids. And one of the advantages is that we can grow the tumor cell either by itself in a spheroid, or we can start to add other cell types to the spheroid to see what the crosstalk between different cells are and what's the importance of the different cells in terms of tumor formation. Now, as you've heard, although ovarian cancer is a catch-all term, it's a very fairly rare cancer. There's about 2,600 women in Canada diagnosed annually. So it's much less frequent than breast cancer, but it's quite deadly because of those 2,600, within the year, not the same ones, but yearly, about 1,600 die of their disease. So it's, and one of the things that, so the tools that we can use, we used to use the blunt tools to characterize it, is just looking down the microscope what we could see. And so one of the things was how invasive, how angry does the tumor cell look? And we can also look, we used to classify them by histology. They don't look the same. So some of them, the most frequent one is serous, but you had endometrioid mucinous and clear cell. And in the old days, everybody just did all their experiments on ovarian cancer, even in the lab. And many labs used to take any ovarian cancer that came along. They used to mix them all together, and they try to make sense out of it. And many of these old studies we now have to disregard because since they didn't take this into account, what they were really looking at was alphabet soup. They thought they were looking at one thing, but really they're looking at a whole series of diseases at the molecular level. And so it was very hard to draw any kind of good conclusions from them. So where do we want to go? We want to go to what we call personalized medicine, where we're really putting a more emphasis on customized healthcare, saying that even if you have ovarian cancer, it's not all the same cancer. Most of the studies we used to do, like I said, we would look at thousands of women. Some would respond, some wouldn't, but after that, we'd give everybody the same treatment. And now as we understand more and more about the molecular basis of the disease, we realize that we have to stop doing that, and we have to really start treating the tumor, the cancer that is presented to us in clinic. So one of the things we use, or we hope to use more in the clinic, is the use of biomarkers. So what's a biomarker? You've probably heard the term in different talks. It really is any kind of general substance that you can use as a biological indicator. So it's like a beacon, and it's like a roadmap and tells you what's going on. And it can either be the DNA, it can be the protein, it can be in urine, it can be a metabolite, it can be in blood. So it actually is something that we can test. And when we test it, it tells us something about what's going to happen in terms of the disease progression. So you've heard of an example that's already well known in ovarian cancer, breast and ovarian cancer. We can do genetic testing for the risk of developing these cancers. And we know that women who have mutations in the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes are predisposed to developing either breast and or ovarian cancer. So we can use that test in the genetic clinic as a first way of looking at a person's risk. So it provides us, it is at the same time a biomarker. Now you've heard speak of the different forms of ovarian cancer, and essentially this recapitulates it in a different way. But basically, if you look at the serous cancers, it's not one type of cancers. They're actually high-grade and low-grade cancers. And the low grades are usually the good actors, and the mutations they have are not the same as the high grades cancers, which are much more aggressive. And then we have these other different types, which histologically under the microscope we could see they were different. But now we recognize that the mutations molecularly, they're very different also. So how are we going to use this information? Well, we're going to try to use this information to really try to predict, first of all, what's the course of the natural course of the disease. So that's what we call the prognosis. So two people may present with a cancer. It looks the same on as a microscope. Somebody might have very aggressive disease and die within a year, and some might live up until 9 years. So you've heard that the average is 6, but in between that, there's a whole variation, and not everybody lives exactly 6 after. There's also what we call, we want to be able to predict what's going to happen. So when a patient comes, what we'd like to know is what therapy should we be giving? Which ones are going to be useful? Which ones are not useful? So that we can spare people needless treatments that are only going to be toxic and for which they'll derive no benefit, versus treatments that are better adapted to the type of cancer that's being presented. So these, but in order to be able to tell that, we need to have these beacons or these biomarkers that allow us to decide which treatments to give. Now, you've heard in the case of PARP, one of those is, in fact, mutations in the BRCA genes. So we know that if there's a mutation in BRCA, the patients are much more likely to respond to the PARP inhibitors. But we also know from the phase 2 trial that there are some women where we don't see mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2, but also respond to the PARP inhibitors. So there must be other genes out there that are also going to tell us about response. And so we have to search even harder to find these biomarkers. This is just a bit of work that we have been doing, a protein that we've been working on for a long time. And what we originally did is we did one of those molecular profiles that you saw where we took women who had low-stage disease and we took women that had high-stage disease, and we asked, well, which proteins do we see, which genes are really turned on in the aggressive cancers? And one of the ones we focused on is something called RAN-GTPase. And it has very important functions in the cell. And when we looked to see, did it predict prognosis, we weren't surprised that it did, because we know that patients with low-stage disease do better, patients with high-stage disease do worse. We picked this protein because it's expressed in high-stage disease, so of course it's associated with prognosis. But when we took the patients with high-stage disease and then looked how much of this protein is being expressed, we could actually separate it in two groups. So this is what's called a Kaplan-Meier curve. So on here, this is the number of months that are survival, and these are events as they occur over time. And so as if this is overall survival, what you see is that women who express very little of this protein, even if they had the most aggressive disease, they die less and live longer than those that have this aggressive disease. Now, why is this important? It's not just important in terms of patient management, but it's also a good way to go look for new therapeutic targets. So, in fact, one of the most exciting new drugs in breast cancer is Herceptin, but it started its life not as a therapeutic target, but actually as a prognostic marker. So, initially, when it was first discovered, it was shown that women who overexpressed this receptor, which is called HER2, they actually have a worse prognosis than most women who have breast cancer. They finally created an antibody against this, which is trastuzumab or Herceptin, as it's known in clinic. And now we know that women who show this anomaly, if we treat them with Herceptin, they now do much better. And so is this true for all prognostic markers? Well, we believe in the case of RAN-GTPase it is. We've shown that if we take tumors and we take away their RAN-GTPase, they can't form cancers anymore. So we are now collaborating with various researchers at McGill to develop new drugs against this. So now I've spoken to you, and we've spoken to you at length about biomarkers, and I've just given you one example in the case of PARP, where even when we think we know who should be responding and some of them with BRCA mutations don't respond and other people who don't have BRCA are responding, it means that these biochemical pathways are very complex and interact a lot. And so actually being able to predict who will respond or not will probably not be a single biomarker, will be a whole series of biomarkers. So it may be a very complex process to be able to figure out who's going to respond and who's not. Probably not insolvable, but it will be complex. So to finish up, I'd just like to talk to you about a little bit of work that we initiated in my laboratory a few years ago. And it's really taking a completely different tact and saying, well, maybe biomarkers are too complex and it'll always be a statistical calculation over whether somebody will respond or not. So maybe the best thing to do is just to try to see if we take a tumor out, whether we can have an assay that can rapidly tell us whether a person is responding or not to chemotherapy. Now, People have tried this in the past. The problem is that these experiments take a long time. We often have to grow the cells in culture, then we have to grow them in mice. So we might have an answer months and months later, but that's way too late for the clinic to make a decision. You're not going to wait until your mice tells you that maybe you should be treated or not with some drug. So what we did is we actually took advantage of miniaturization, something called microfluidics, so the ability to do experiments on a very, very small scale and to see whether we could find a way to test rapidly whether we could find whether cells were dying or not following a chemotherapeutic agent. So basically the scheme is, I told you about these spheroids, these balls of cells that sort of look like tumors. So we started it as a proof of principle with these balls. And what we do is we can load them into these devices, and then we can color cell with dyes, and if it's green, the cell is alive and happy and living, and if it's red, the cell has died. And there's always a few background cells that are not happy. But we can also give them chemotherapeutic drugs. Here, the same drugs that you heard about, carboplatin, paclitaxel. And what we can see is that we can show killing in this. So we can see cells that are responding to the drugs and those that are not. So we can use this system. Now, making balls of cells is maybe fun in the lab, but that's not the real world. So how are we going to translate this to how we treat people? So one of the ways that we can do it is actually thinking about biopsies. What are biopsies? Well, they're small pieces of tissues that we can slice up with some of the, for example, this is called a vibratome, and we can take live cells and a piece of tissue, and we can chop it like salami into these tiny, tiny little pieces that we can now load on these microfluidic devices, and that we can actually show that we can have live or dead cells. So the idea going forward is that, you know, maybe the medicine of the future is going to be that when you have a cancer, you'll have a biopsy, and then we'll test all of our chemotherapeutic agents, the targeted agents, the broad-spectrum agents, and we'll see which ones do in this device work the best, and that might help us to predict then which ones are better. So I don't know which one is going to be the right answer in ovarian cancer. It may be that in some cases biomarkers may work better. It may be in some cases that actually empirical testing of the tumor is going to give us the best results. But this is the type of thing that we can do with tumors. So really to conclude is I just wanted to point out that tumor banks are really an important resource in oncology. They need to be professionally maintained, so it's very important that we have high-quality tissues, high-quality clinical data, and they really are a gift from donors to the tumor bank, and they represent a legacy because many of these tissues actually are valuable years after they were collected, and in the case of ovarian cancer, unfortunately, after women have passed away. And interrogating these tumors is providing us then with the key discoveries that allow us to now start to contemplate a more personalized cancer medicine. Thank you.
So thank you, Anne-Marie. There was one question to Dr. Gottlieb that came down, and I see there's some other questions that are ready for Anne-Marie. The question was, is the CA125 blood test effective?
I don't know who asked it, but thank you. So CA125, that's one of those tests that was used in that study that I showed you and in most of the screening studies. So CA125 is a very important test, but it's a test when the tumor is already established. It's not good for screening or detection. It's excellent to follow the tumor, so we use it every day. But it doesn't really help us for screening, because by the time it's elevated, you already have so much tumor around that it doesn't help you.
Okay. Could you please say something about newer techniques such as intraperitoneal ports and effectiveness?
So I don't know if you paid attention to that slide which showed the improvement in months of survival, but there were a lot of squares in red and there were a few orange squares. The orange squares, which were really at the top of the graph, are with intraperitoneal chemotherapy. So what these studies showed is that if you give the chemotherapy right into the belly, you improve the outcome. So those studies showed clearly that if you give the treatment right where the tumor is, you improve the outcome. Now, like Anne-Marie said, things are not that simple. Because the Japanese came out with a study that we have applied where instead of giving the chemo intraperitoneally, if you give it every week, you get exactly the same results. So what we believe today is that intraperitoneal is a way of exposing the tumor constantly to chemotherapy. And that by giving the treatment every week rather than every 3 weeks, you can mimic that. And the survival data from Japan is very important. So we're doing actually from the group from Dr. Mesmasson, Dr. Provencher is doing a big international study that she's leading comparing those dense chemotherapy, which is every week, with intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And I think that that will give us the answer. But yes, intraperitoneal chemotherapy did much better.
Okay, another question. If a woman has a hysterectomy, will that prevent her from developing ovarian and cervical cancer?
Well, it depends what you call a hysterectomy. Per definition, a hysterectomy is removing the uterus. If you remove the uterus, you don't remove the ovaries or the fallopian tube. So you don't really remove the source, neither the fallopian tube nor the ovary, of the ovarian cancer. However, you do decrease your risk. And what we know from studies is women who had a hysterectomy have a risk that is decreased compared to the general population. What you do decrease, for sure, is the risk of cervical cancer because you do take out the cervix.
Okay, at least two of the same questions, and I guess either of you can answer it. To you, Dr. Gottlieb, you mentioned that ovarian cancer starts in the ovary, but have you ever collaborated with Dr. Lucie Gilbert, I guess, whose latest research shows that it starts in the fallopian tube?
Thank you. So first of all, we need to clarify as to who did the discovery of the development of ovarian cancer in the fallopian tube. So in fact, how it was discovered is pathologists were actually looking in women who got prophylactic oophorectomy. So they had their ovaries and their fallopian tubes removed because they had BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations. And what they were looking for, because these are women who decided to take their ovaries out before there was any large cancer, but the pathologist says, let's look very carefully at the ovary and the fallopian tube. In each of these cases, in fact, much more carefully than we've ever looked before, to see if we can see cancer starting. And what they noticed is that in these women, they often could find lesions within the fallopian tube, and these lesions had P53 mutations, and as was mentioned, this is one of the specific lesions that are associated with high-grade serous cancers. So that brought forth the notion that, in fact, ovarian cancer, at least in some cases, could begin in the fallopian tubes. We now recognize that it actually probably also can come from other sources depending on the type of ovarian cancer. So we know that perhaps certain kinds like endometrioid and clear cell may come from an origin that's related to endometriosis. But what we do know is that the ovary is a rich niche for which when the tumor cells settle there, they grow, because when we first look at them, many of the women have the tumors in the ovaries, and we know that some ovarian tumors seem to begin within the ovary, and we don't see anything in the fallopian tube. So there's probably not a single place where it originates. There are multiple, and what brings them together is perhaps the site of growth and why we call them all ovarian cancers.
Okay, I know what you and I will answer to that, but let's see what Dr. Gottlieb says. Is it safe assumption that all cancers result from gene mutations?
I'm not sure it's from mutation, but sure from their expression pattern.
Yeah.
So yes, all cancers are related to expression of genes and their products. So it's really there that we need to find the answers and the cure.
Do these mutations across different types of cancers, breast, cervical, colon?
Well, that's we started out with that geographical and topographical understanding of cancer. You know, cancers that start in the ovary are ovarian cancers. Well, in the ovary, there are, like Dr. Mesmason said, there are very different types of cancers, and some of those resemble much more the kidney than they do resemble another ovarian cancer. Some of them resemble way more a colon cancer than they do. Yeah, I agree. They resemble much more a colon cancer than they do an ovarian cancer. So, yes, some cancers have way more in common with other sites of origin than they do with the site they come from.
Yeah, and in fact, although there's not going to be probably ever a clinical trial to address that, but we now know that in some mucinous cancers, what we see is amplification of Herceptin, the HER2 gene, and there is a notion that in these women, they would respond to the same type of therapy as women in breast cancer that have Herceptin. So we're going towards more the molecular characterization of tumors may be much more important in driving how we choose therapeutics than actually the physical site where it initiated.
Any comments on the poor progress in developing reliable biomarkers?
So part of it I mentioned in my talk is there has been a confusion in the literature in terms of biomarkers, especially in ovarian cancers, where people have made it into a big melting pot. So they took every ovarian cancer and they studied it as if it was a single disease. And not surprisingly, depending on which mix of cancers they had in their tumor bank and they put in their studies, they could get completely contradictory results. So a biomarker that may be good for serous, if you look at it globally, it may actually be a very poor indication of survival, but it may be good within serous. So part of our lack of progress has been only the more recent understanding of the general research population that, you know, not all of these cancers should be binned together, and we have to look at them individually. The other problem is that in order for us to be sure that a biomarker is good, we can't test it on 10 samples or 100 samples. We really need to do it on 1,000 samples. And this is one place where the Terry Fox Research Institute is coming to help translational research. In Quebec, we have a number of ovarian cancer biobanks. Dr. Gottlieb directs one at the Jewish, I co-direct one with Zien Provence at the Chum. We are networked together within the province to help overcome the lack of samples because it's a rare cancer, and now we're taking a rare cancer and saying actually it's five rare cancers within a rare cancer. So none of us have enough samples really to do large-scale studies. So what we've done is we've created a pan-Canadian consortium, which we both belong to, which is putting together 2,000 samples from women across Canada and will really give us the numbers and the statistical powers to make more progress in our biomarker research. And eventually then we will bring those forward into prospective clinical trials, the more complicated but smaller number trials that we're doing.
I think the next question is worth mentioning because where can I get my genes sequenced for $8,000?
I'm sure not the address. There are companies in the U.S. There is a company called Baylor that I know. There are a few companies in the U.S. that will do full genome sequencing for you. The problem is you won't know what to do with the answers.
Exactly.
They'll find all kinds of stuff, maybe 10 years from now, 15 years from now. This might be helpful, but they'll find all kinds of stuff that we don't know what to do with. You'll be different than your neighbor, but we don't know if that's going to be something good or bad.
A very interesting question. Can you please discuss the mechanisms of PARP inhibitor resistance a bit?
I don't think that the clinical trials have gone far enough for us to look specifically at resistance, but one might expect it might be like in the cases where you target BRCA1. In certain instances, what they find is that in tumor cells that have a mutated copy and a normal copy of BRCA1, what happens is that the tumor cell, which is continually reorganizing its genome, actually pops out the mutated form that makes you susceptible to the drug, and now you're left with two wild-type copies, which now protect you from the drug. So we've seen this with other drugs, and we suspect with PARP we may see the same thing.
I think Pumpkin is telling us he wants more seminar. So we'll continue, and we'll continue with the questions and answers after. Our next speaker is again Dr. Walter Gottlieb, the new frontier for gynecological cancer surgery.
So this is going to shift gear a little bit to something a little bit more light and pretty enthusiastic eventually.
It will come.
So one of the things that Dr. Mesmason said, and you know, as a team, you know, all of us can, everyone can do more together. And I think it's very important that we work together in those big consortium to try to find the answers, because it becomes more and more complicated than we really need it.
That's
a 754
meg, right?
That's a small one.
That's small. I mean, old computer.
Ah. You want mine? I should continue talking?
Yes.
No, I think we are in a very exciting time for people in cancer research, because we get all those tools, some of them that Dr. Mesmason was describing, all those new tools. This is a very exciting time to be in cancer research. The same way that Fleming had the opportunity to discover antibiotics, we see it. It comes. We are often frustrated it doesn't come quick enough. We're doing those small steps. But as you saw in that curve, we continuously improve. And as long as we French, they say, qui n'avance pas recule. As long as we go forward, I think we'll get there. And it's a very interesting period. Now, this is very different.
There you go. Sorry.
That's no problem. Let me just go one back. Can I go one back? Probably here. Oops. Yeah. So here we're going to shift gear completely to something which I find very exciting, which is also part of that new future that we see, which is robotic surgery. And I'll talk to you a little bit about that, introduce you to concepts. So, you know, in these type of things, I have a lot of conflicts in my life, but I don't think any of them are of your interest. So we'll just keep on. So three parts of that presentation, very quickly, and it's 10 to 8, yeah. So first, what is robotics? What are we talking about? What does it represent? And the robot actually that's used all over the world at this time, there is only one. It's called Da Vinci. And not by chance, because Da Vinci was the first one to develop a robot. And already at the time of Da Vinci, the robot was developed for warfare, as you can see here. And the robot that we are using today in the clinic actually was originally organized by the U.S. Army to improve the efficiency of soldiers. And in the second part, it was taken over by NASA in order to be able to operate people that would be in the space station and the surgeon would be on Earth. So the surgeon would manipulate instruments that would operate on those people in the space station. So they were looking forward. And ultimately, it was taken over by Stanford. And these are the first prototypes at Stanford. And this is how it looks today in the operating room. So what we have is we have a surgeon sitting at a console, a little bit like a cockpit, and he moves those arms that basically go through very small incisions in the abdomen and operate in the abdomen. And I'll show you a few examples of that. So I don't know if that means he agrees or not. So this is the United States, and I'll show you the rest. This is 1999. The first three robots in the U.S. And I'll go very quickly with the implementation per year. I'll let you... 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. I don't know if I have 2011. No, I don't. So very quick, and in Europe it's about the same thing. We could see a very strong implementation, a logarithmic implementations of those robots in Europe. And that's Canada. So obviously we have not been big pioneers, and this is true to 2012 with two new robots in Quebec in 2012. But in Canada, we always take things with a little bit of humor, and nevertheless, we try to play a role internationally on what we were doing. So the robot had difficulty integrating in Canada, and I tried to find a reason. And I think that the reason goes, when you have any new technology, any new philosophy, think people go to a certain level. And I'll let you go through the five levels here. And I spent last year at Harvard, so I learned a few things there. So today I look at it a little bit differently. So in life you have innovators, early adopters, middle adopters, late adopters, and never adopters. Now, if you look at the curve of those, the innovators, they make about 2% of the population. And they're involved in the new vision. They see the future. They're geniuses. They're just 2% of the population. Then you have the early adopters. They are the people that know it when they see it. They see something, they know, that's what I need to do, and they go for it. Then you have the middle adopters, and that's the majority of the population. They can be influenced, but usually they will prefer the status quo, and they will prefer what they know, rather than the unknown. But ultimately, you'll be able, if you try, to convince them. The late adopters, ultimately, if the majority will take it, they will go along, but they'll never admit it. And then the never adopters, they will live in the past and they will die saying it's bad. And we, surprisingly enough, our medical colleagues were a lot against this. And we were very surprised back 5 years ago when we started the robotics program, exactly 5 years ago, that a lot of the resistance came from our colleagues. So, understanding this very quickly, we realized that we needed to show them the outcomes. We needed to show them what we felt was true. We needed to analyze and show it to them with numbers. So I learned very early on, if something is important enough for you, you need to be able to put a number on it. If you can't put a number on it, not important. And obviously a detail, the cost. So we needed to, one of the big concerns was that the whole thing was very costly. And we needed to show hospital costs, societal costs, you know, use it the right way, and what the impact would be on something very Canadian, which is the waiting lists. Okay, so this is my philosophy. I'm a surgeon, but I fundamentally believe that surgery is an injury. We, as surgeons, are licensed to aggress people with a knife. And we need to be extremely careful for that. Society has given us that power, that privilege, and we need to use it well. And it's an injury that we hope is as controlled because of all of these reasons. Now, from a patient's perspective, the value of a surgery is going to be a division between the efficacy of the surgery divided by the invasiveness. If I can provide the same efficacy with way less invasion, the value for the patient is way, way higher. And we had laparoscopy. We had what we all know is laparoscopy, small incisions, and we were going to do it. And this is a study that was published back in 2007, exactly when we started our robotics program in the United States by hyper-specialized surgeons, right? People who had at least 8 years of training in surgery, at least 8 years. And you see that for their use of laparoscopy for endometrial cancer, they never offered it. More than half of those surgeons never offered it to their patients. What less than 25, the majority of the remaining ones offered it less than 25% of their patients. And only 6% offered it to most of their patients. So obviously we had a tool and nobody used it. And nobody could benefit from it. So this is basically it. 6% basically of the population, of that whole population, benefited from minimal invasive surgery. Then comes the robot, where everything is more intuitive. The surgeon sits down, as you can see at the console, and whatever his hands does, so do the instruments. The instruments have 7 degrees of freedom, which is more than a normal hand, which has 5 degrees. And the instruments are extremely small, allowing you extremely precise surgery. Does that translate to improvement? So let me show you this just for relaxation. This is an origami. It's a one-minute origami done with the robot. I'll just let there are two moralities at the end of this, but I'll let you enjoy this. So just by a show of hands, how many do an origami here? How many can do an origami? Not the majority. So the first morality is arriving. So look carefully. Here comes the first morality. And the second morality is, if you cannot do an origami, the robot is not going to do it for you. So you first need to know how to do surgery. And then, using the robot, you could do it more precisely. Oh, enough. So we had now to prove the advantages. And I'm going to show you the advantages very quickly, because that's a little bit boring. This is where the rubber hits the road. This is a graph of our department. In yellow is the percentage of surgeries that were done by open surgery. Classical, traditional open surgery for these diagnoses, cervical cancer, endometrial cancer, and sarcomas. And in blue was laparoscopy. And consistent with the study I showed you, about 15% of our patients we did laparoscopy, which was a small minority. December of 2007, we get the robot and we do our first cases. Within 1 year, 2/3 of patients get their surgery by minimal invasive surgery. Within 2 years, 95% get their surgery by minimal invasive surgery for these cancers, which are very big surgeries overall. And that has remained plateaued at 95% of surgeries performed robotically for these cancers. We then started analyzing our data because people started to. And very briefly, this was for cervical cancer, which is one of the subjects of tonight. That's the only thing we're going to hear. Here you have the blood loss. We compared open surgery to robotic surgery. Blood loss went from 500 cc to 100 cc. We looked at all complications, I mean, including everything. Went from 63% to 19%. Length of stay went from 7 days to 1.9 days. And interestingly enough, the cost dropped from $12,000 for a surgery done openly to $8,000 doing it robotically. So not only was it better, but ultimately, it was also cheaper. We did the same then for endometrial cancer, and that data was just published. Here we took all the endometrial cancers before the robot, and all of them after we started doing the robot. And we compared all of the patients, 160 versus 140, the first 140 here. Blood loss went from 260 to 73. Complications, 41 to 13. Hospital stay, 5 to 1. Overall cost, 10,000 to 8,000. So I think that the resistance that people had, the only way to block that is by showing them the numbers. So this is just an example. This is the first hysterectomy in China that we were able to do. We did the first one by the robot in China back 2 years ago, actually. And it just shows you the instrument. So this is not one word of English in that OR. Everything by sign language. So you start the surgery just by putting those instruments, laparoscopic, you can see how we put in the camera, and then the surgeon goes to sit at the console. And what you see that the arms move with the instruments. These are the instruments inside the belly, those very small instruments. And the surgeon, by moving his arms, is basically, and looking into that cockpit he has, moves basically the instruments, and here you can see it on the camera, how those instruments move, and allowing big movements to become extremely precise and extremely small. So that's it. That ended up haunting. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. And that's why it is so important for the future. We've seen that the patients that are the most at risk of surgery, which are the elderly patients, we did a study on those specifically. And I just wanted to add this because I think this is fun. So what this is the number, the age of the population, male and female, back in 1971. So you can see most of the people are in here, are pretty young people. And at that time, back in 71, I thought everybody was old. But obviously I was wrong. And then when we look at the evolution over the years, 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010, now I think everybody's young, and I'm wrong again. So we clearly have an aging population, and we need to make sure that we give them the best surgeries possible. And it's not going to get better. And what we've shown in our patient population is that the people over the age of 70, despite of having more comorbidities, more other diseases, and of being at a higher stage and grade of disease, they were more aggressive diseases, these elder patients had the equivalent perioperative outcome. They did as well as the young ones. And they had an improved quality of life compared actually to the young one. Maybe something to learn from our elder patients. This is just one graph I'm going to show you about the elder, which I find is very interesting. What you have is percentage of people here from 0 to 60% and what they use for pain medication after surgery. And you could see that 40 to 50% of them, in red it's the younger, in orange it's the elder, use nothing for pain medication after surgery, which is completely unheard of for these type of surgeries. Most of the ones that use something, they use NSAIDs, and very little use morphine. The other morality is, again, the elder patient use less pain medication. There are more of the elder using nothing than the younger one. Something to learn. So the other one were the obese patients. They're also at very high risk of surgery. They have a lot of complications. So we studied the obese specifically. And obesity is a real big problem. These are stats of obesity in the U.S., where what they show to you is there is no data here, and you see 10 to 14% of the patient being obese here. Now look over the years. This is 1985. Ooh, doesn't work. Okay, let's try it. Okay, 1990, 1993, 1996, 99, 2000, 2001. You could start seeing all kinds of other colors. There's almost no light blue left, right? So basically, as you could see, it's becoming a real problem. Obesity is really a major issue. And then I thought, that's the U.S., right? Let's see in Canada. Well, actually, the numbers in Canada are a little bit the same. So when you look at Canada, you could see that from coast to coast here in black is overweight, 70%, 50%, 60%. They're a little bit better in the 60% range in the West. But you could see that the overweight range is also between 60% and 70%. And that's the reason. We're not hunter-gatherers anymore. But again, when we looked at, we divided our patient population in three, the normal weight patient, the obese, and then the morbidly obese. And when we looked at various variables, consult time, which is surgical time, blood loss, complications, we saw that basically it was equivalent whether you were morbidly obese or you were normal. So somewhere the robot allowed us to neutralize the risk of surgery for obese patients in the same way they did for the elderly. So this is kind of the type of cockpit that we're working with. At this time, so here you see what you're doing. This is what you see on your screen. This is a three-dimensional vision. And then you can have overlapping images. This is not yet available on every day, in everyday life, but this is how things will evolve, where you're going to have images from MRI, images from ultrasound at the same time you operate. So you'll be able to see multiple images, and you see in real time where the vessels are, where the tumor is, while you are operating. This is a simulator. We have at the hospital, we have a simulator where we can allow our trainees to practice their surgeries before. So today they are very complicated. We don't have it yet, but there are very complicated programs that allow you to rebuild the whole person based on MRI and CT scanners in three dimensions. So you put in that information into that simulator, and you can train the night before on the surgery you're going to do the next morning. That already exists, where you could have the tumor exactly where it is, and that simulator really prepares you for the surgery. And I can see that my trainee, if he doesn't score 99 the evening before, he doesn't get to operate. Right? You shouldn't. This would be a very nice way of decreasing the risk of surgery. So this is my last series of slides. This is a beautiful airplane, a beautiful engine, a Spitfire, with which are fathers and grandfathers kept the world free during the Second World War. And this is the type of fighter pilot planes we have today. So I don't know about you, but if I have to go to war, I'd much rather go in this. Now, it doesn't take anything away from the big pioneers who started out the whole flight experience. They are really the giants on which we stand. But even a dwarf on the shoulders of a giant sees further than the giant. And I think that that's really where we are today. And I think that the future of surgery is completely changing. I think surgery is really getting out of the hands of the surgeons, in the sense that now we have a computer, a little bit like a pilot. We have a computer between us and the patient. That computer can analyze what we do. That computer can give us feedback. That can do digital analysis. That can stain the tumors during surgery and analyze what we're doing. So it's really that computer, like in the fighter, that really is going to bring us to the next level in surgery, in the same way that molecular biology is bringing us to the next level in treatment of cancer. Thank you very much.
How much time does it require for you to become able to do this?
It's actually the company is called Intuitive, and it is for a good reason. This is like doing open surgery. It just doesn't take very much effort. I can tell you what we went through and what the people I go proctoring go through. They do a session in the lab, basically where they work on that simulator. They watch for one day somebody doing surgery, and they do surgery on pigs one day, and then they undergo 2 days of proctoring. And after that, they're on their own. So within 4 days, you've learned to master this thing. It is so, for somebody who does surgery, it's just simply intuitive. You just go into it.
Is the Jewish General the only hospital in Quebec which has robotic surgery available? I think you said there was another one in Quebec.
No, now it's really catching up. This year it has catched up dramatically. So at this point, since this year, we have one at the CHUM that started their program in May. We have one in Quebec City, and they started their program last month. We have one at Sacré-Cœur, and we have one at the MUHC here, at the Montreal General Hospital, that started that program just a year ago. So at this point, it is really catching up.
Okay. Is it only used for endometrial cancer, or can it be used for something else?
No, it can be used for many things. At this time, we used it mainly for cancer treatment, to the proof of concept, to show that it really is worth using. We can't use it for things you could do simple surgeries with by the laparoscope. You need to use it for complicated things where it's a little bit like laparoscopy when it started out. They started doing the things that were difficult to do differently. And then you can expand it to other stuff.
We'll continue with the questions after our next speaker. Thank you very much, Dr. Gottlieb. So to end our evening, we have a very special presentation from a patient. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Susan Drasner-Berkovich. She actually is an employee of McGill, I guess. She's actually trained at McGill. Yeah, a school teacher. Come in. A graduate of McGill with a bachelor's in education and a master's in education.
Get away with this. Not wearing these.
There we go.
Ooh, I don't like this. Ready?
So you're talking to me.
Okay. I stand here tonight not as a professional speaker, but as a grateful patient, a cancer survivor, who could not say no to Dr. Gottlieb. I mean, how could I? When a man you credit for saving your life turns to you at a checkup and tells you, and I quote, "On March 17th, I want you to tell your story, be funny, and inspire people to support the weekend to end women's cancers," it's hard to refuse. So there I stood, ready for the first time to relate a story that had never actually been told to an audience of strangers. It was a turning point for me, as it was the first time I ever uttered the word survivor. Tonight will be the second telling of my story, and still I do not call myself a survivor. I am just an ordinary girl, robotic surgery patient number 28, coping with whatever comes my way in an effort to show others some fights are just never over. Voltaire once said, "Each player must accept the cards life deals him or her, but once they are in your hand, he or she alone must decide how to play the cards in order to win the game." My life changed on February 19th, 2008. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I arrived at the St. Mary's Hospital for a routine D&C, after which I returned to work promptly. The plan was for me to have a checkup and pap smear 6 weeks later. So, on April 8th, I presented myself at my doctor's office. My husband, Jeffrey, had offered to go with me, but thinking it was a routine visit, I went alone and, frankly, without a real care in the world. I am a natural optimist, or I was until that day. The visit was anything but routine. Rather than an examination, I was ushered into the doctor's office. Let's be clear, not Dr. Gottlieb. I had not yet met him. This doctor just stared down at my file. He finally looked up and said, "Your pathology from your D&C is in. You have endometrial adenocarcinoma, endometrial type moderately differentiated, FIGO grade 2. "What?" I said, not understanding one word, except perhaps carcinoma meant cancer. He proceeded to tell me that my pathology results indicated that I would need a full hysterectomy as soon as possible. Here I was, all alone with the news that with a doctor who proceeded with this news and with a doctor who proceeded to draw pictures of my cancer, thinking that I could actually process this new information at this time alone. I was confused and immediately somewhat angry inside. Why had he allowed me to come to this appointment alone? Why had he waited almost 6 weeks to contact me? And what would my next step be? He never once said he was sorry. He never looked into my eyes as he delivered the words that would change my life forever. While he continued to talk, I regained my composure and decided to take charge. Anyone who knows me would tell you that that would be the case. I asked if he knew Dr. Walter Gottlieb. He said he didn't, and he couldn't connect me to him. That was when I knew I was in this alone, or so I thought. I rushed to my car and sat in the driver's seat for a long time before putting the key in the ignition. I realized anyone else would be crying, but I am stubborn. And when I don't like the message, I just don't react to it. I would find a way to help myself. Do not worry for me. I was used to using myself for emotional support. I have been doing it for years. Actually, I'm known for offering sound advice and reason to many around me. The next few hours and days unfolded quickly, and I realized that while this was happening physically to me and the cancer was in my body, I was not alone. I also knew that I would have to find a way to help myself and to enlist those who were well-positioned and who cared for me to help me. First and foremost, that meant my family. That includes my incredibly supportive, if not completely emotional and medic-phobic husband, Jeffrey, who didn't handle the news well, but has handled everything else with love and support and humor, and yes, emotional outbursts, but mostly with love. Next, I called my sister Nancy, my mentor and friend. Being in the healthcare field in the United States, she always knows what to do, and in this case, she once again guided me every step of the way. Calm as always, she told me to get a piece of paper and take down the following list of things to do. She began. First, prepare a letter to the doctors requesting a copy of my files to date. Second, provide a letter of release so that any doctors needing any further information would have access to that. And most importantly, Susan, third, find a way to see Dr. Gottlieb. Dinner was quiet, and I told my daughter, Stephanie, then 22, and Jessica, 20, that the next few weeks were going to be hard. There were some difficult decisions to be made, but I was confident that things would turn out well. I made the three of them promise not to say one word to anyone until I found a game plan that had been created. With the help of some good friends, I was able to obtain contact information and encouragement to reach out to the best of the best, Dr. Gottlieb. And that night, after midnight, I dialed Dr. Gottlieb's office. At the sound of the beep, I recited the following. Hello. You do not know me, but this message is for Anna, a kind and compassionate woman who I think can help me. My name is Susan Drasner-Berkovich, and I have recently been diagnosed with endometrial cancer. Having had a pituitary adenoma and surgery in 2004, I know the importance of being examined and treated as soon as possible. If you can find it in your heart to help me, I would truly appreciate hearing from you. My voice had cracked by the end, and I slowly hung up the phone. The very next morning, shortly after 9, Jeffrey received a call, and he heard, "We will help you. Please have a copy of Susan's file brought to our office, and I will ensure that Dr. Gottlieb reads it." By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they had all the paperwork, and by the following Thursday, I had my appointment. By the way, that is why I'm here tonight. When someone responds as quickly and compassionately as Anna, and someone as kind and empathetic as Dr. Gottlieb asks you to be there and show up, like they did for you, there is no other answer. On April 17th, 2 days before my 52nd birthday, and 9 days after my diagnosis, at 1:30 in the afternoon, I arrived at the Siegel Center and took a seat in the waiting room on the 7th floor. It was scary, to say the least. Everyone was at different stages of the disease. Some looked great, some looked pale, some had wigs, and some had bandanas on their head. The volunteers were smiling and kind, but nothing could relax me at all. Jeffrey and I sat holding hands in the chairs waiting for my name to be called. Neither of us said a word, nor did we look around. No one wants to be seen, no one wants to talk, and everyone looks to the ground. My turn had come, and I first met Nancy Drummond, Dr. Gottlieb's nurse. Dr. Gottlieb entered the room and looked up at me. He introduced himself, and after a short talk, he examined me. He confirmed what I already knew, but he added, "With a hysterectomy, you will be all right." I had a list of questions which I had prepared with the help of my sister and asked if he would have time to answer them. He took my hand, looked into my eyes, and he told me he had all afternoon. Patiently and kindly, he answered each and every one. He told me he would put me on a list for robotic surgery and do his best to get me there as quickly as possible. His face was kind and his voice was soothing. I knew if anyone could or would save me, it would be him. He told me to go home, not to worry, and I would hear from him very soon. I got dressed, thanked the nurses and the volunteers. Jeffrey and I walked silently to the elevator around the corner. He took me into his arms and hugged me. We said nothing. Finally, we said in unison, "Did you see his shoes?" So it was then and there I knew that my fate lay in the hands of the man with the really cool shoes. you realize that humor and attention to foot fashion live on even with a cancer diagnosis staring you right in the face. Things move quickly from there. On May 8th, 4 weeks after my initial diagnosis, I had my surgery, and on May 9th, I left the hospital on my own 2 feet. This enhanced recuperation was important to me and my family, but also to my students. I'm a teacher at Solomon Schechter Academy and was concerned about leaving my classes so suddenly in the middle of the year. Due to this new and wonderful robotic technique, I was able to recover completely and rapidly. I returned to work on May 20th. Thanks to this advance in medicine, which the Jewish General Hospital made available to me through Dr. Gottlieb, I only missed a total of 32 teaching hours. That is remarkable. After that, I met another remarkable doctor, Dr. Boris Bohorwick, and had a series of 3 sessions of brachytherapy. I am now followed by both Dr. Gottlieb and Dr. Bohorwick regularly, and I'm very grateful for their care, compassion, and most of all, their support when it is needed. My story really should end here. But in December 2011, Jeffrey and I met with my brain surgeon, Dr. Gerard Moore, who reported the results of my recent MRI. He confirmed what I had suspected all along. My pituitary adenoma had returned, and immediate treatment was necessary. In January 2012, I began a series of 30 brain radiation sessions for the pituitary adenoma that had reoccurred. Today, I stand before you, cured for now, tumor-free, cancer-free, and very grateful. For the last almost 8 years, I have experienced what many of you would consider to be an exaggerated series of medical tests, procedures, unusual and frightening diagnosis, treatments, and unlikely twists and turns. I don't stand here tonight to tell you about those details, because that you can read in my book. I stand here to tell you that we are living in amazing times, surrounded by amazing people in the medical profession. I stand here because I am incredibly fortunate. You might think that it's a crazy title for a woman who has been diagnosed with 2 brain tumors and cancer and who has endured 1 8-hour brain operation, 1 8-hour robotic surgery, 3 treatments of brachytherapy, and 30 treatments of brain radiation. But yes, I am a lucky one. I have a tremendously supportive family. I have had resources that have allowed me to endure my diseases and to provide me with what I needed when I needed it. And I figured out how to play the game, to gain access where I needed it and to enlist help from likely and unlikely sources to get the best outcomes possible against all odds. But I have been like an embedded reporter in a war zone. I have been an observer of much of our health system, its actors, its victims, its care recipients. And I stand here tonight to tell you that each of you who has not been personally touched by cancer has a job to do going forward. I am here to lay out a challenge, one which I feel you will want to accept. Get involved. Let's help advance medical care and healthcare system caring so that everybody has the best shot at terrific clinical outcomes, such as I had with robotic surgery and state-of-the-art radiation, but also at experiencing a healthcare system which allows compassion and support at a time when women and families need it most. From my personal experience, I learned many things, but most importantly, I have learned the value of not walking alone. Some people have to deal with this all by themselves. I did not. I was surrounded by a small, well-chosen little group of people who I would allow into my new world. I drew on my inner strength and tenacity to pave my way. I tried to take it day by day, and I did fall down often. I cried a lot, mostly in the shower, as I thought about the ordeal my family was going through. They were trying to be strong at a time when their entire world was falling apart. I recalled that Katie Couric, my favorite news anchor on the Today Show, lost her husband, Jay Monahan, in 1998. She returned to work shortly after, and when questioned as to why she did not take more time at home, she remarked, "I am the mother of 2 girls, and I want to show them what they should do when life throws them a curveball." Let me tell you how I've chosen to get involved, and let's see if you can't find a place for yourselves. Dr. Gottlieb's suggestion, I now work for a group called Gloria's Girls out of the Jewish General Hospital. Many of the women are here tonight. Together, over the past 8 years, we have raised over $1 million for ovarian cancer research and awareness. What I am about to say may make some of you very uncomfortable, and someone very sorry he chose me to address you. But I feel it's a very crucial piece of why I'm here tonight. I could continue to talk about the wonderful doctors, the people I met along my journey. I could praise robotic surgery and how grateful I am to have been given the opportunity to benefit from it. However, that would not be my best contribution. I want to speak for those who do not have the courage, the opportunity, or the strength to speak for themselves, to allow you to know what I believe cancer patients need most. What I think, would like to think of as small changes with great impact. It has been said that scars remind us of where we've been. They don't have to dictate where you are going. I refuse then, and I refuse now, to allow my disease to dictate how I will live my life. But my experience after my cancer diagnosis wanted me to do just that. At that time, there were no services offered in the evenings or the weekends for cancer patients and their families. There were no support groups or nutrition classes which I could go to if I did not want to define myself by my disease. Robotic surgery was truly remarkable. It had physically cured me, and I was well enough to return to work immediately. My family was in shambles. They were scared, uncertain of the future, and afraid of a reoccurrence. They needed to be with others to share their concerns, ask their questions, and enlist support. I was the one who had always provided that for them, and here I was again, forced to do just that. To date, and I apologize for this, to date, the visit I had to the wellness center was the most frightening experience, more frightening than two brain tumors and cancer. I never felt so alone, so helpless as I did there. There were so many who work for Hope and Cope, so many who want to help others. Yet, as I underwent this ordeal, every service I received, every piece of information I obtained, I had to seek out myself. I realized that some things have changed since 2008, but some things remain the same. As I went to the basement of the Jewish General Hospital for my 30 radiation treatments, I was struck at how many arrived alone, waiting hours in silence. The waiting room needed magazines, better DVDs, sketch pads, blank notebooks, and people walking around talking to you about life in general, telling you jokes or stories, and informing you about your wait time. When machines broke down, people waited for hours. No one came out from behind a desk or an office to keep you informed. This is an easy fix and would add so much comfort to those who are feeling so alone. Last month at my checkup, I found out that the stress tablets, another reward from the fundraising efforts of Glorious Girls, indicates that women are worried. There are still no exercise classes, relaxation classes, or yoga for those who are in treatment. Friends want to do things for them, but they don't even know what they need. Others are shy to ask. Families need food, not for the patient, but for the rest of them. Families need company, not for the patient, but for the rest of them. Children need to go to movies, to parks, to have someone sit with them while they do homework, not because they can't do it themselves, but because their parents are tired, scared, and need time alone too. They need to hear stories about times when things were running more smoothly, when they were in control of their own lives, and they need to laugh. They need to have someone hold their hand and tell them it's going to be all right and it's all right to cry. No one ever said that to me, and I was too afraid to show anyone how scared I was. With a circle of incredibly supportive people around me every day and doctors who made me feel that I was their only patient, my tears were always shed when I was alone. I would like to propose a challenge. I'm near the end. I'm a teacher and an active community member with a very large circle of friends and colleagues who have already agreed to help me. In the upcoming weeks, I'm going to hold an evening to recruit a minimum of 20 volunteers who are willing to donate their time and resources to help cancer patients and their families. We would like to volunteer to organize activities, both recreational and educational, for them. We will arrange art activities, games, sports activities, homework assistance, holiday programming, exercise classes, you name it, we will do it. When I asked the Wellness Center years ago about this, they told me it was difficult to get workers to work on the weekend. That was unacceptable to me. I can do that. I will find schools, synagogues, municipal halls, gyms, fitness centers, all willing to give me rooms for their services. I will provide teachers, social workers, psychologists, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, fitness instructors, artists, all willing to donate their time and resources to helping others. I will do it now. I will advertise them as Montreal's finest people, which is borrowed from our latest fundraising project, who have chosen to give back to help others and to pay with the finest of currency, their time. I will partner up with anyone who feels they want to help me. And my contact information is pretty easily obtained. Not every message is easy to deliver. Not every patient is as lucky as I am. I still look over my shoulder and believe that cancer is running to catch me. and I know that other women do too. I think about my profession where we spend so much of our time trying to get students to face front and pay attention to what's going on at the moment. I will take my own advice, or try to. I do slip, but it would be nice to know that when one of us women does turn back and look over our shoulder, one of your friendly faces could be there encouraging us to look ahead and concentrate on times to come. Leo F. Basaglia once said, too often we underestimate the power of a touch, a smile, a kind word, a listening ear, an honest compliment, or the smallest act of caring, all of which have the potential to turn a life around. And so it is true. I am asking you to pay this forward. Find someone to tell about this evening. Help me as I begin my volunteer program. Everyone's lives have been affected by cancer, and while we cannot ensure a cancer-free world for our children, perhaps we can ensure that our grandchildren will not have to witness what we have. Thank you for all you do as volunteers and professionals. A special note to anyone who, as I am, is a cancer survivor. Always keep your nails manicured, as someone will always want to hold your hand, and always wear great shoes, because someone's always looking down at your feet. Good night.
It's not easy.
Oh, yeah.
Would you answer a few questions?
Sure.
Okay. Teacher, can I get this?
Yes, sir, please. Thank you so much. And what you say is so true. I witnessed the same thing in 2001, and I don't think it's changed all that much.
I want to be the first to ask a question. When you did my robotic surgery, did you put me on pause? Because it looks like a video game.
I always wonder.
Questions?
Are they really going to call me?
It's Berkey, Berky, at simpatico.ca.
You can contact my office if you want, or email and I'll give it to whoever wants to volunteer.
What's your name?
My name is Jerry Redden.
Going to help me?
Good.
I've got one. I'm 19 left.
Any other questions you'd like to ask Susan? Or Dr. Gottlieb? There was one question that we didn't answer before. If we have an endovaginal ultrasound every time we have a gynecological exam, would it decrease the rate of ovarian cancer?
So the question is if an endovaginal ultrasound would help decrease the risk of ovarian cancer, and unfortunately the answer is no. By the time you could see it on an ultrasound, it's already so big, it's already a few billion cells, and by that time it won't make a difference. We need to go to what Dr. Mesmason said. We need to find better ways, molecular ways, to be able to find them before it happens. And again, the good news is it's underway. Using an ultrasound device that, you know, I started to use when I was a medical student 30 years ago is really not going to be the answer. We need to be more inventive and more adventurous to try to find and put into research the resources to find better ways.
Could you briefly explain what the difference would be between a CT scan and an MRI?
It's just a technique. CT scans and MRI give about the same images. It's just that the CT scan is using X-rays, like for a plain X-rays, whereas MRI use magnetic fields. So it's just a different way of obtaining images.
Do you use the results in a different way?
They're overlapping. Some of the results with one is better than in some results with the other. So CT and MRI give overall kind of similar images. The MRI being a newer technique and not using X-rays, basically, is a little bit, I would say, more of the new era of where we would like to go.
So Anne-Marie, Susan, would you please just step up here? Pumpkin has decided the evening is over. So would you join me, please, in thanking our three speakers of tonight? Before you leave, we would also like to thank the committee members, Dale Boydman, Rosalind Goodman, Sheila Notkin, Marla Schuster, the staff members who helped to organize this, Annette Novak, Duncan Robertson, and Petal Steele. And I thank you very much. The next evening is on April 31st? No, 27th or something. You will, of course, be informed. We hope to see you then. It is everything you have wanted to know. I know that... Bone cancer. And there will be another event in June on brain cancer. So thank you for coming. Drive very safely if you're using a car, and particularly around here with all the construction. Thank you so much.
I'll try to see about the shuttle.